This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And coming up, student athletes from the class of 1972 are finally being recognized for their participation in high school sports after graduation, 50 years after graduation, but before Title IX ever became law. It's coming up, but right now. Ever gone to bed hungry? How'd you sleep? Ever go to work hungry? How'd you perform? Ever go to school hungry? How'd you learn? President Biden held a conference on hunger, nutrition, and health last week. His administration announced a plan to try and tackle food insecurity and diet-related diseases like obesity, diabetes, and hypertension. The president's proposals include changes to nutrition labels and expanding meals for children both in and out of school.
Because in every country in the world, in every state in this country, no matter what else divides us, if a parent cannot feed a child, there's nothing else that matters to that parent. If you look at your child and you can't feed your child, what the hell else matters?
We're learning more about some of the causes and potential solutions for hunger and nutritional issues in Wisconsin and the United States at large. And we want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. See issues with hunger in your community? Maybe you work at a school or in healthcare or a nonprofit organization. What do you see? Share it with us, please. Or what about nutrition problems? Are you dealing with rising rates of obesity or diabetes in your area? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Andrew Reese, is Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic Analytics Lab at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, and he's a fellow in the Department of Medical History and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of the book Eating to Learn, Learning to Eat, The Origins of School Lunch in the United States. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us, Beth Olson, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the Nutritional Sciences Department at UW-Madison. Beth, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
And Beth, I'll begin with you. What did you see from the President's Conference on Nutrition and Food Insecurity last month? Evidently, it's the second ever that we've ever held. What came of it? What did you see?
What I felt was so different about what we've been doing in the past is he really tackled hunger with a much broader lens. So in the past, I think we did a pretty good job of putting together programs that helped feed people that were hungry. But he's looking at it much more broadly about how do we bring families up, which is why I think he talked about some of the economic programs. Now, I'm not as familiar with those, but of course, being able to provide for your family will do a long, go a long ways towards helping people not be hungry. I think he also looked at it across agencies in the government, but also public-private partnerships. He looked at driving it down to the local level where people know what's best for them. And then I think the other really big point he brought out is hunger isn't, you know, distributed uniformly across our population. We have people that are very much at risk. People of color are more likely to be hungry or food insecure. But he also brought up disabled people, elderly people, people with many children that are in school. When schools shut down, they may be extra hungry, but also things like our LGBTQI plus community and rural populations. So I think he really recognized the broad nature of the problem and then the different kinds of people and the different ways it might be affecting them.
And Andrew, I want to ask you about the story from the WPR News this afternoon about the loss of universal free lunch and how some Wisconsin school districts are now seeing some students skipping meals. How big of an issue is hunger in Wisconsin as compared to the rest of the country? And give us some perspective of how we got to this point, please.
Sure. Yeah. So it's a real problem. For the last several years, schools have benefited from a temporary program that allowed them to provide essentially universal free meals to students and even to students' families. And that went away this past summer. And we've seen both in Wisconsin and nationwide a real decline then in ability to participate in that program. There have been a few states that have introduced legislation to guarantee universal free meals. I believe California, Vermont, and Maine up to this point. But other states, it's basically reverted back to the pre-pandemic system where Either schools had to qualify through community eligibility, or individual students had to qualify for free or reduced price meals, and that's making it harder for many families to participate in one of the key nutrition programs for children in this country.
Andrew, from your position, Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic Analytics Lab at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, is this money well spent? Is this an investment that would see a return on investment? Or is a universal free lunch program giving things away that may not be necessary or could be considered wasteful?
Yeah, so most of the research suggests that it would be highly beneficial. There's research on benefits to children's health. There's research on improvements in future earning potential. There's a host of research on improvements in education. And so, most of the research suggests that a universal free meal program has significant benefits for children in school. But as with many, nutrition initiatives, sort of at the policy level, the debate is often less about whether something like school meals are beneficial, but the question of how much it will cost and whether the cost benefit works out, the way that people want. And so much of the debate about whether we should have a universal free meal program nationwide or even at a given state revolves around, whether the costs justify the benefits.
Andrew Ruiz is Associate Director for Research at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, and Beth Olson, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the Nutritional Sciences Department at UW-Madison. Our guest invites you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Where do you see food insecurity across Wisconsin and beyond the schools? But Beth, I want to ask you about the Universal Free Lunch Program and the story from WPR News this afternoon of students now going without lunch without this universal program. You'd mentioned before that food insecurity isn't across the board, that it's in certain pockets, in certain places, and that where we're seeing it is, affected differently depending on who you are and where you are. So how can a universal free lunch, or where do we begin to find food security, and we can start with kids, that that can be considered a sound investment going forward for all?
Yeah, I think one of the things that President Biden spoke about and is in their report is looking locally at schools. Can we connect them to local foods so that when kids have school lunch, it's not only local foods, which help local farmers, but it might be more likely to be foods that they're familiar with, that are a part of their culture and a part of their community. I think the other part is removing some of that stigma of getting free lunch so that every child, whether they are having a low income, less income in their family or not, can access that lunch without feeling that there's any stigma or shame. Another thing he talked about, which I thought was really interesting, is let's recruit from our communities into food service. It's being reported that there isn't enough food service employees to cook foods for children. They're getting packaged foods because there isn't enough people to cook. He talked about in his report, it's discussed about recruiting and training local people and providing them with quality jobs. So at the same time as cooking good food for our children, we're employing perhaps their parents and other people in their community and allowing them to have the income that they can begin to provide for their families too.
It's interesting to me that not only are we talking about food insecurity, but at the same time, we're talking about obesity. And Andrew, could you square this for us? How is it that there is a connection between food insecurity in this country as well as obesity?
Yeah, so it's obviously a very complicated issue, but when we're talking about children in schools, as many as 10% of them are in households where there is regular food insecurity, where their parents don't necessarily know where the next meal is coming from or can't guarantee that there will be food available for all meals. And that's not inconsistent with there being large rates of obesity and other diet-related diseases, in the same population. As Beth pointed out, right, these things are not symmetric across populations. And also, it's important to note that, some people are getting enough food if we just look sort of at gross calories or other sort of measures, but they're not necessarily getting the kind of food they needed, as Beth was saying, right? That, you know, many schools are struggling right now, for example, to sort of meet standards for school meals because of labor shortages and because of supply chain issues and a whole host of other things that make planning, you know, healthful and appetizing meals for kids much, much harder. And so all of these issues are kind of entangled in different ways. But, you know, one of the things that's really important about the White House conference is that it's helping to bring national attention, not just political attention, but orient the public towards a lot of these issues, which has the potential, as it did in 1969, to really mobilize support for really expanding and overhauling how we think about nutrition policy in this country.
And Andrew, that 1969, that was our first, at least until the latest one last week, our first ever conference on food insecurity and diet-related diseases?
It was the first sort of under that title, but it's also important to remember that there were White House conferences on, for example, child health and protection that have significant nutrition components as well. But yes, it was the first that really focused on hunger and nutrition. You know, it really mobilized not only popular support, but political support for a broad range of child and adult nutrition support programs, many of which we still have today. You know, but these are also programs that need to be reauthorized constantly, and that sometimes languishes. You know, there are several bills right now that are part of that that are still sort of working their way through the process in Congress. And so it's also important to remember that these kinds of conferences provide great sort of activation energy for mobilization, but there's sort of a long, difficult road ahead if we actually want to realize a lot of those recommendations.
Andrew Wyss is the Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic Analytics Lab at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research. Also joining us, Beth Olson, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the Nutritional Sciences Department at UW-Madison. Invite you to join us as well at 1-800-642-1234. Do you bristle at the thought of universal free lunches? Do you not see them as an investment, or do you understand or have perhaps benefited from them in the past? Have you experienced hunger yourself? What was it like, and how do you overcome it? 1-800-642-1234. Could the solution be as simple as food? You can also email us ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation next on Central Time. It's Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and right now we're picking up our conversation on nutrition and hunger after President Biden held a conference on the issues last week. And our guests are nutritional science professor Beth Olson and education researcher Andrew Ruiz from UW-Madison. We'd like to invite you as well to join us at 1-800-642-1234. What do you think about the Biden administration's proposals to improve nutrition and address food insecurity? Do you support expanding meal programs at schools? You want to see wider eligibility for food stamps or the WIC program in Wisconsin? What other solutions do you have? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Gary in Hartford this afternoon. Gary, you're on Central Time.
Hello. Yeah, I'm wondering about the school lunches where there's so much waste in the schools and we have meals that are one size fits all. We've got meals that go to one small child that's also supposed to feed one of our older adult child, and yet there doesn't seem to be an even distribution of calories across the board.
Ah, the same caloric intake for a kindergartner and a sixth grader, and then the amount of waste that we find from our food programs. Where would you like to begin, Beth Olson?
Yeah, I think looking at using local foods and also looking at cultural preferences, as well as, I think, you know, just some really good old-fashioned home cooking versus some of the packaged foods that people are needing to use right now because of shortages would go a long way towards waste. I think in demonstration projects where there's more involvement of the children in the recipes, where there's more cooking, where the children get more nutrition education, making use of things like community gardens really increases the amount of food that children eat and really decreases waste.
Andrew Ruiz, what do you see there when it comes to school lunches, the amount of food waste we have, maybe beyond the cafeteria, but just in our own kitchens, and the one-size-fits-all approach for school lunch programs?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Beth on that. You know, the research is very, very clear that the more that a school lunch program, you know, incorporates students into not just, you know, the food line, but into the preparation, into the planning, you know, the more the programs are integrated with education, and the more they are based on a kind of scratch cooking model that can be much more sensitive to local populations, there tends to be quite a lot less food waste and a lot more participation, both of which are significant benefits. And this is, you know, this is true in many cases in home kitchens as well, that getting kids interested in foods and food preparation early is a great way to get them to try new foods. It's a great way to get them to cultivate a taste for a broader range of foods. And it's a great way to have conversations with kids about, you know, where the food comes from and issues like food waste and preparation.
And Andrew, a follow-up here. It seemed from the conference last week that the Biden administration is leading into the idea of food as medicine. How do you see that concept?
Yeah, so the recommendation that that the government can support things like nutrition prescriptions and support for meals that are sort of medically designed to help people with different health conditions was fairly prominent in the White House conference. You know, of course, historically, it's a very old idea. Food as medicine has been practiced for thousands of years across pretty much all cultures that we know anything about. And it continues to be a sort of focus of you know, many for many advocates, especially nutrition advocates. You know, one of the biggest challenges is that medical training still involves very little training on nutrition and on sort of the ways in which health professionals can support patients in particular dietary changes or adjustments that they may need to make for their health. And so that's a really big area of opportunity.
And Beth Olson, also from last week's conference, the Biden administration announced a proposal to move nutrition labels from the back to the front of food packaging. What good would that do?
The proposal is about a front of package label, and there are many of those already going on. So we have our side panel, which has the nutrition facts, the nutrition in the food, and the ingredient listing. I personally think one of our efforts should be to help people read those two places of information. They're very regulated. They're very accurate, and I think provide most of the information that people need. It is a lot of information, which is why I think people are interested in having some symbols on the front. Right now, there's a lot of information elsewhere on the label, some of it regulated, some of it not. Some of it's just advertising. And so it can mislead people into thinking they're picking up a healthier product than they are. So I'm in support of it, but I think that it's just one more tool, and I don't think necessarily is going to be the answer to everything.
We had talked earlier about the president's conference last week on nutrition, food insecurity, and food health, and how it was, you know, it get attention, but after that comes the important part of legislation and furthering something through. And some of the president's proposals face some political hurdles. The conference last week was called partisan by some Republicans. In fact, Senator Mike Braun, the Republican from Indiana, who sponsored the legislation to fund the conference, while he appeared at an initial hearing, did not appear at the rest. There was some tepid response from the other side of the aisle last week. So is there a Andrew, do you see politically feasible anything that could get through Washington, D.C. that could help people in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it's one of the biggest challenges, I think, of the proposed slate of policies is that the sort of highest impact ones are all ones that are going to need to get approved by Congress, you know, making permanent the child tax credit, universal free school meals, you know, expanding eligibility for SNAP. Some of the diet prescription coverage we were just talking about, and so on and so forth. And this is not a Congress right now that seems well positioned to pass any of those at this point. So I think, you know, one of the things that we want to look for coming out of a conference like this is to see how well it mobilizes existing groups. There's a lot of groups on the ground who are already, you know, and have been for a long time working for these kinds of goals. can this conference mobilize them to really help push these things through, a Congress and that may or may not be that willing to support them? And so I think that's going to be, the thing to really pay attention to in the coming year is how well this, this provides the activation energy for that kind of effort.
Beth Olson, do you understand some of the arguments against these proposals for food security and nutritional health? Could this be considered wasteful? Is there opportunity that could be left on the table here? Or is this just good old-fashioned partisanship as you see it?
I think something that people, perhaps the public doesn't understand, and as Andrew mentioned, having this publicity for the conference and our groups out on the ground working, perhaps we can also talk more to the public whom elect our officials about what having good health, nutrition, health, physical activity means for the entire population. I've never heard a politician say that they would rather have an unhealthy workforce and a less productive workforce and a military that's, not well nourished or healthy. So I think when we start to talk about the things that make, the United States strong and the people within it strong, we're talking about a healthy children growing to be healthy and productive adults who work and pay taxes and take care of their families. And that's that these kind of programs support that. So I think when people begin to understand it's in all of our best interest that every one of us be as healthy and productive as we can, perhaps we can start to influence our politicians to see it the same way.
And Beth, what are some other brief potential solutions out there that could help address hunger and or nutrition in Wisconsin?
I think there's a lot of potential to the school, to local foods, to school initiatives, also to local school, to places like food banks. I think it helps both the farmers and it helps the people receiving the food. I also feel I need to promote Extension. I work with them and they just have wonderful programs and they are based in the community. So they recruit people to work for them that are from the community, understand local issues, they know where the people in their community go to school and work and where they go to church and what their stores are like and their parks are like.
We are out of time, but I appreciate the mention of the Extension this afternoon. Beth Olson, thank you so much for joining us. Andrew Ruiz, thank you as well to you.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Ruiz, Associate Director for Research in the Epistemic Analytics Lab at the Wisconsin Center for Education Research, and Beth Olson is Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the Nutrition Sciences Department at UW-Madison. With us today, looking at the Biden administration's proposals to tackle hunger and nutrition issues in the United States. A huge thank you to everyone who participated in our fall member drive. Just wrapped up on Saturday, over 9 days. There were 5 special incentives, 1 huge participation challenge that lasted over 2 days, and more than 2,000 of you made a gift to WPR. And I was one of them, as so many that I work with was, because we get to see this, the results, every day. And so the drive's over with, but I wanted to take a moment to thank you, each and every one of you personally, for participating. And if you missed the drive, there's still time to join in with your gift anytime at WPR.org. And when you do, you can ask for the tote or you can ask for the socks, but really the important part here is to thank you for being a part with us. It's what we do every day and we get up ready to do it, even on a Monday. So thank you for keeping us going, keeping us ready to do it again tomorrow. Well, we still got more to come today, so stay tuned. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, Queen Elizabeth's death sparked both controversy and praise for her 70-year reign as the British monarch. However, a historian joins us to talk about the British colonial rule that so many have criticized. Now, Student athletes from the graduating class of 1972 at Stevens Point Area Senior High have finally been recognized for their participation in high school athletics. Students from that class graduated just 2 months before Title IX was signed into law. That happened June 23, 1972. Graduating class from May of 72. The Title IX prohibits sex-based discrimination at any federally funded educational institution. And female athletes from that graduating class back in 72 have now received their chenille letter S patches and certificates in honor of their participation, making them lettered varsity as student athletes from 50 years ago. Our guests, Sue Gast and Mary Rozicki, are two of those female athletes from the graduating class of 1972. Sue and Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Also joining us today, their former high school coach, Judy Jancourt. Judy, thanks for being here.
You bet.
So I'll start with you, Sue Gast. Take us back to your senior year in 1972. It's your first graduating class of Stevens Point Area Senior High. What sports were you playing, and what was it like to try to play them?
Well, it was interesting. When we first started playing sports, especially girls' sports back then, in our sophomore year, it took us till our junior year to actually play boys' rules in basketball. There were actually girls' rules in basketball. And when we advanced to the boys' rules, we thought we were pretty big stuff then. But playing the sports, we never had like really organized team sports where you'd get on a bus and travel to like Wisconsin Rapids or something and play against other teams. It was more like a play date.
Yeah. And was it hard to get that date? I mean, was court time easy to find?
Well, most of the problem was trying to get the practices.
Yeah.
We always had to work around the boys' schedules just to get time to practice, whether it was early in the morning or later in the evening. That was the problem.
So now you are a lettered varsity student athlete 50 years later at the reunion earlier this year. And Mary, tell us a little bit about why this was important for you.
It was recognition that had been previously ignored. We were working just as hard at sports as the boys, but we got no recognition for being female athletes. So it was long overdue and a wonderful, wonderful surprise.
Yeah.
Judy said surprise, yeah, to pull this all together and present those letters to our friends, our fellow athletes, and most importantly, to our coach.
Judy Jancourt, you tell us a little bit about what it was like to be an adult in the room here trying to help these women, young girls, find ways to compete and play.
Well, back when they were in school, trust me, it was very, very difficult to set up any type of organized sports like basketball and volleyball. They were not recognized by the state. So therefore, they were useless as far as the school is concerned. We managed to put together some play days. Sue recognized the fact that we started with girls' basketball rules and finally went into boys. And I myself, in my time, I played six different kinds of girls basketball. So I knew how they felt about this. And I was so happy to be involved with helping out with getting the letters to the girls. That was far, far overdue.
Far, far overdue. And Sue Gast, what did Judy's leadership mean to you?
Well, she was an inspiration. She made it fun. She showed us, she was a great coach, great teacher, great mentor. She inspired us. She encouraged us. You know, it was keep going. She treated it like a sport. She didn't treat it like, you know, like a play day, you know, like we're just going to sit here and just toss the ball around or something. She made it a competitive training. She was really good. She always has been.
Mary Rozicki, were you paying attention to when Title IX passed later that year in 1972 after you'd graduated high school and what it could potentially mean for future student athletes?
Honestly, no.
Mm-hmm.
No, because we've been ignored for so long that it wasn't I just didn't know about it. I just didn't know about it till later.
And it really didn't take effect.
Right.
Until later.
Yeah. Yeah. So, until after we were out of high school.
Well, then did you begin to see yourself as part of that push towards equity in Wisconsin and high school athletics?
Help us out, Judy.
Well, I was very aware of Title IX.
Okay.
And I pushed for our conference. Our conference was very male dominated and their sports were very important. And for example, after Title IX, I came up with a situation or a solution to having sports at our field house every Friday night. And I had a whole plan laid out. I worked very hard on it and I presented it to our conference ADs, and they laughed me out the door. So that's just one of the things that happened, and that was after Title IX.
And Judy, you'd go on to become, if I'm not mistaken, assistant athletic director at Stevens Point Area Senior High in the 80s and 90s, correct?
That's correct.
And just for some reference here, when Title IX was signed into law, the year before Title IX was signed into law, there were, and these numbers come from the Stevens Point Journal, 4,300 high school girls competing athletically. Now, these days in Wisconsin, there are more than 3.5 million. Sue Gass, do you think there's still work to be done to create better equality for female athletes?
Definitely. Definitely. If you look at training facilities, if you look at attendance, if you look at promotions, if you look at coaching, the parity that you have with the salaries for coaches, female coaches versus male coaches, there's a lot of work left to be done. But the wide variety of sports that are available to female athletes now, you look at hockey, soccer, boxing, wrestling, things that you never, or football, mm-hmm. things that you never thought women would be involved in, has evolved.
And Mary Rosicki, if there were a high school girl listening who find themselves frustrated with the access to participation in athletics, with just equity in the school system, what would you say to them?
Don't give up. Find a way. Figure it out.
Yeah.
Find a mentor. Find an older student, find somebody that can help you realize your dreams.
And do you think, would this have happened for both you and Sue if Judy Jenquart had not been there at Stevens Point Area Senior High?
Absolutely not. Judy is so instrumental in moving women's sports forward in our part of, you know, Wisconsin, central Wisconsin. She was a leader, a mentor, a visionary. You know, she helped us completely, and my girls benefited by it because they both played sports at Spash.
So Judy, as the visionary here, where do you see female sports going from here? What's next? Where's the fight for equity take us?
We can't give up. We've come a long way and it's been wonderful, but we have so far to go when it's all equal. And that's important, so important to us, especially to our women athletes today.
But when Mary talks about her daughters, it's important for tomorrow too.
Oh, it is, and it's so wonderful that her girls are playing. And that's thanks to Mary and her background. And she played hard, and she passed that along to her kids. And I think it's just wonderful.
Well,
now we're on to our granddaughters, watching them have the opportunities. I have a 6-year-old granddaughter, and this is her second year participating in a volleyball camp at UW Eau Claire. So her second year. There was no such thing when we were growing up. There were no club teams, or we didn't have practices like the girls practice now, and the traveling that they get to do, and just having a uniform. We didn't have any of that.
I want to congratulate all three of you and thank you all for joining us this afternoon. Truly a celebration. Thank you all.
Thank you for having us.
That's Sue Gast and Mary Rozicki and Judy Jancourt from Stevens Point Area Senior High. And they took a look at their lettering for their varsity letters that they received at their 50-year high school reunion. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and today's story comes from our friends at To the Best of Our Knowledge. They introduce us to a Wisconsin woman who gave her kidney to a complete stranger.
Last year in March, on Facebook, there was a little girl in our town that needed a kidney. My daughter looked at me, she goes, you know, Mom, you would match up with her blood type. So I called the hospital where she was working through. And that's how the process started.
This is Missy McKenna.
I had to go through all these blood tests and all these tests and everything. And then they tell me the little girl, she had gotten a kidney and that her transplant was going forward. And I felt I'd gone so far through the process. I said, okay, that's fine. I've come this far. I'm not going to stop.
This is such an incredible story, an incredible case.
This is Missy's surgeon, Josh Mesrich.
I have so many donors tell me this is the best thing they've ever done. And of course, that's my goal.
To lose a kidney?
That part.
Why do they think it's the best thing they've ever done?
Because they're saving these lives. It really is. It is like the kind of person who would run into a burning building to save someone. Now, the donors do really well. When you look at the numbers, the risks are low, but it's still surgery. It's still this leap of faith. There's going to be a recovery. There's going to be pain. Who has a month out of their life that they can go through this? But I do want to be clear. Our donors do very, very well, and I hope your listeners will get to hear it.
All right, so this is the operating room. There's our patient, actually.
Missy, how are you?
Put it right on your face and let you just fill those lungs up with that good stuff.
Once a surgery starts, it really is this puzzle. You're really focused on doing the case. You're not thinking at all about, my gosh, this is a person with kids or with parents or something like that. I think when things go disastrously wrong, then you start to get these moments of thinking about their family. But during an operation, you're really focused on the task at hand. You almost don't feel like you're operating on a human. You're just trying to put the puzzle together.
Psoas to the right, diaphragm in front of us, kidney to our right, spleen to the left. We're past the adrenal now. He just doesn't want to stick his blade into the diaphragm. It takes 1 millisecond to put a hole in the diaphragm with the harmonic. We're almost ready to start flipping the kidney. We're in really good shape.
I think every surgeon has to have this proverbial box. And in this box, you can kind of put your complications and you can keep them there. You need to be able to close that box so you can go home and be with your family, be with your kids, and not just be constantly agonizing. But you also need to be able to open that box and be with the patient, see them every day and say, we're going to get through this.
Once we get the kidney out, we'll move it to the back, flush it. That's critical. Once it's flushed and on ice, then we can relax. All right, are we good? Is everyone good? We got everyone we need? Push down all the way across. I think you're great there, dude. Perfect. Fire in the hole. Love that. There it is, left kidney, two arteries. I'm happy with it, Clark. I think it looks great. It'll fly across the country, and then, it'll get plugged in, and it'll start working right away. It's just awesome.
You know, that's amazing. I always want to help people. So, I'm glad that I could save somebody's life. You know, I guess being a part of somebody else, I don't even think about it. I just hope that their life is more enjoyable.
This story about kidney donation came from our friends at To the Best of Our Knowledge from WPR and PRX. It was produced by Shannon Henry Kleiber. To hear the full story, and trust me, you do, go to ttbook.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, an historian talks with us about the controversy surrounding the death of Queen Elizabeth II and her connections to British colonialism. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and coming up tonight after 6 on 1A Plus with Jen White, the Supreme Court's reconvened following a term of new legal precedents, and the justices are poised to issue more life-altering decisions in the coming months. So what should we expect from the Supreme's new term? That's tonight after 6 on 1A Plus with Jen White. Now, after the death of Queen Elizabeth on September 8th, some people responded with praise of her reign, while others reflected on her time as queen with some criticism. When Queen Elizabeth inherited the throne, more than 700 million people across the world lived under British imperial power. Mo Banerjee is an assistant professor of South Asian history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and is with us today to talk about the Queen's role in colonialism. Mo, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
So much of Queen Elizabeth's reign happened after British colonization. More than 55 countries gained their independence while she was queen. So why is she being criticized for British colonialism in after her death?
This is a very important question. And I think here it is a question of the queen as a person versus the queen as the face of the institution of the monarchy. And while we say that she was the face of decolonization, each of these decolonized nations fought very long and very hard to gain their independence from the British Empire. So on one hand, she is a woman who had a history of stellar service to Britain. And on the other hand, she is the face of an institution which for almost 300 years ruled over a quarter of the world. I think in some ways it's the thing where she is the institution and the face of the institution that is drawing criticism rather than Queen Elizabeth as the person.
I think paraphrasing a title of an op-ed from the New York Times this weekend, mourn the Queen, not the Empire. So what does the British colonization look like in today's world? Where does the British Empire stand right now, Mo?
The British Empire is, in practical terms, non-existent. The Commonwealth still endures. However, given that most of these countries decolonized within the last 75 years or so, there are still living descendants who have private and personal experience of the empire as a very real thing. I think it is the experiences of these people and their descendants, the horrors, the loot, the subjection and the grief of the empire, which is bringing up a lot of complicated memories across the globe in all of these decolonized nations.
And you want to separate the monarchy from the person, but how did Queen Elizabeth II specifically play a role in all of this? Did she make decisions, and did those decisions have life and death consequences across British colonialism?
Well, the government is Her Majesty's government. So in a sense, whatever decisions were being taken by the British government, those had the imprimatur of the Queen's consent. We really do not know the extent to which she might have known in depth about the decisions that were taken, but it is her consent and her signature that lay behind every single intervention in all of these colonies. It is after her colonization that the Mau Mau Rebellion is suppressed violently in Kenya, that violent guerrilla tactics are used to suppress uprisings in Aden, in Cyprus, in many other British colonies. It is after her colonization that the British government essentially burns and destroys documents which might have caused, as they called it, embarrassment to Her Majesty's government. Essentially, there is a very living history of grief. So while she might not have personally known, or we do not know if she personally knew about some of these decisions that were taken, all of it was carried out in her name, in the name of the monarchy of which she was the face. Therefore, I think it is very difficult to disentangle the queen as a person from the queen as an institution.
Mo Banerjee, our guest, an assistant professor of South Asian history at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Mo, you teach about this in your class. So how are the students reacted after the death of Queen Elizabeth?
They are, I think, far too young to actually even know about some of the ramifications of colonization. I belong to the generation of people whose grandparents were active participants in, decolonization movements and independence movements, especially in India. from them I heard since childhood about the atrocities committed by the British in India leading up to the independence of India in 1947. For my students, it is past history, but even they were very conflicted about the fact that there was Queen Elizabeth, the face of the monarchy, a mother, a grandmother, a much beloved monarch. On the other hand, they all come from backgrounds which are in some way entangled within that history of subjection, cruelty, of colonization. So there was a very lively debate in my class, and I think we got to discuss a lot of the issues that you're questioning me about today.
And Mo, is there reason to believe we'll see any change in British ruler policy going forward under a new monarch?
Queen Elizabeth, I think, was the last living link to a history of, you know, the World Wars, to that kind of patriotic idea about service to the nation, of a Britain which was actually a global superpower. It is during her own life that the empire essentially imploded, and post-Brexit, Britain is now no longer among the great superpowers of the world, even though there is a huge xenophobic backlash after Brexit, and that there is a lot of imperial nostalgia. But I think the sun has truly set on the British Empire with the death of Elizabeth. There is no real need for a monarchy in government in a place like Britain. I think the monarchy should come to an end.
Mo Banerjee, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Mo Banerjee, Assistant Professor of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, joining us to talk about why some people are criticizing Queen Elizabeth for her impact in British colonial rule. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, what to do with Wisconsin's share of the opioid settlement funds. We'll be talking with a lawmaker, an addiction expert, as well as a community organizer, and hopefully you as well, as we size up what's next for dealing with the opiate epidemic in Wisconsin.